with the subject of spatial correlations. And the next topic that I'd like to treat is correlations and the susceptibility. So first of all, actually, were there any questions? I forgot to ask. Okay, good. Okay, so I'd like to relate some of the things that I talked about last time, the correlation functions and the correlation lengths, diverging correlation lengths, and things like that, to the to things that you can measure experimentally. And for a magnetic system, like the ferromagnetic icing model or any ferromagnet for that matter, what you can measure is actually you can measure the magnetization, the magnetic moment per unit volume, and you can measure the magnetic susceptibility if you change a magnetic, if you apply, for instance, apply a small magnetic field to a system which, say, is, for example, in its disordered state, so that in the absence of a field, it would have no magnetic moment per unit volume or polarized magnetic moment per unit volume. If you apply a small magnetic field, you'll induce a small magnetic moment because the moments align with the field. They align with the field because they lower their energy, but on the other hand, they're at some finite high finite temperature, so they maximize their entropy by not being polarized or aligned. So there's this competition between energy and entropy, which leads to this linear response in the presence of a magnetic field. Okay, and that linear response, the ratio of the magnetic moment that you get to the field that you apply, is called the magnetic susceptibility. Okay, I mean, you can define it, you can just think of it as the derivative of the moment with respect to field. That's exactly what it is. Okay, so let's start with this one observable quantity, which is the magnetization. Call that M. And so M is 1 over N. This is 1 over the number of sites, say, sum over R. Okay, just the average of the average spin. So that's equal to 1 over N, sum over R, trace. Divided by the same thing without the S. Which is Z, of course, down here. It is actually, yeah, exactly. Yeah, if you like, it's the if you think in terms of Fourier space, it's the k equals zero part of the magnetization. If you imagine the magnetization can vary from site to site, and so you Fourier transform it, this is the uniform part. Okay, yeah, but anyway, it's a double average, space and thermal or statistical average. Okay, but the reason why you do this is because that's how you do the measurement. You tend to have a sample, and you can't get in there spin by spin unless you're a neutron, say. You can't get in there and just measure individual spins and then add them up. You measure the bulk magnetization. Okay, so the susceptibility, chi, is just dmdh. And I know I talked about how, well, you know, you turn on an infinitesimal field and so forth, but actually you don't have to do that. You can differentiate this for any value of the field. I mean, even if you have a large field, if you increase it a little bit, the magnetic moment of your sample will increase by a little bit. Unless it's so large that all of the magnetic moments are perfectly aligned, in which case you can't really do much more. But at finite temperature, that's hard to do. Okay, so then let's take this derivative. This is, well, certainly you're going to bring down a beta. And then, that's right. And then you've still got your sum over R. And then what happens up here, you bring down this whole sum over R. So you've got trace SR, and then you've got, let me see, sloppy notation. But anyway, okay, sum over R, SR. And let me just write e to the minus beta h, where h is that whole thing, over, and then let's just call this z. And then, of course, you know, the field's also down here. So you can't forget that. And so that gives you a minus beta over n, sum over r, the same kind of thing. Oh no, let's see. So up here, you've got trace S of R e to the minus beta h. That's as it was. And then, but you bring something up from here, and what you bring up is you could write it as trace sum over R prime, S R prime, e to minus beta h. And then down here, because we differentiated in the denominator, you've got z squared. Okay? Yeah.
Right, you might have said this a moment ago, but in an earlier lecture, I saw chi equals dm by dh evaluated at h equals 0.
Yeah, that's the zero field susceptibility. So here I'm just doing it for, I'm not fixing h to be 0. I mean, you can always do that at the end. You set h equals 0 here, too.
Just
but
depends on what quantity in particular.
You're interested in, yeah. So the way I'm doing it, this is chi of h. And it's actually some nonlinear function, which is linear for small h. Okay. So what is this, okay? So in both cases, we've got a double sum here, and here we've got the product of two sums. Okay? So you can write this, cleaning up my notation slightly, as beta over n. Is that so? Basically, what you've got here you've got a thermal average of the product of the spins at two different places. And here, you've got a thermal average of this spin times a thermal average of this spin summed over all positions where it can be. And I just wrote all the little r's as big r's there. Is there some question here?
Yeah, I was just asking about, like, so before you've done the last thing, the sign, you put, like, four different, like, r's, you put the little r and the r.
I meant some of these little ones to be big ones, but it doesn't matter because these are just, this is like a dummy index, right? It's inside a sum, so you can call it anything you want. Okay, so is everyone happy with this? Now, this thing here, we've called C of R minus R prime. And this here is just M times M, because that average we expect to be translationally invariant, same everywhere, the local magnetization per site. Okay. So actually, yes. If you define, let's call it C tilde of R minus R prime. As you can write it like this if you want. Then see, did I leave out a step here? No, I didn't. Right. Yes, Gunjan.
So you define you define SR as M and SR prime as M. So, but over there, the definition of M involves 1 over N, average of SR. So in that case, there should be an N square in the denominator in that one, because if that has to be M and M, you see, I'm just confused about the notation. I think that's mainly.
The notation is that this guy here, R with no sum, SR with no sum.
Yes.
Is M, based on the assumption or the belief that the magnetization is uniform everywhere. Okay. This doesn't do anything if this is the same everywhere.
Yeah, sure.
You know, you just treat this as one.
Yeah, sure.
And it is.
Sure.
Yeah, okay.
Thank you.
So, okay, so I want to know how comfortable people feel with this, because I skipped a couple of steps here. Like this one here, you might say, why is this the same as this? Is that obvious to everyone or to anyone?
That's fine. So you can only define it like that if it's translationally invariant.
Which is our basic assumption, yeah. And then this thing here, because when you multiply this out, you get the SRSR prime, which is this. You get two terms that are like minus M times the average of this, minus M times the average of this. But that gives you minus 2M squared. And then the last term, which is plus M squared, it cancels off one of those. And so you get back to here. Okay. So this is interesting. Since the, let's just draw this this picture again, this very important picture. So this is C of R, and then this thing here, if you like, if you just take this part of it, this is C tilde of R with the m squared subtracted off. Okay. So this is the thing that goes to zero. Now, so there's an important physical phenomena which is the susceptibility of a ferromagnet as T goes to TC, say, from above. What does it do? As you lower the temperature from infinite temperature down and you come to the towards the ferromagnetic transition, the susceptibility goes up with decreasing temperature, and what happens at TC? I thought I heard the right answer there.
Okay.
It diverges, yeah, it's going to diverge. It's going to be infinite, okay? Now, this thing here is basically an integral of this subtractive correlation function of this decaying, this thing that decays to zero. And if you like, you know, all the terms are finite. Every one of these terms just represents the deviation of the fluctuations from the mean. Actually, above TC, this is zero. M squared is zero, so you know it's just a decaying function. And the so the important point is how can this thing diverge? Okay, we know that experimentally, we know the susceptibility diverges. And the question is, how can this thing, which is essentially an integral, converge, diverge? And the point is simply that there must be an infinite number of terms that contribute to it. In other words, I mean, this we'll show in a second, or we'll illustrate in a second. It's only when the correlations are significant between spins that are very far apart that this integral, this sum here, can give you an infinite result.
Both C of R and C tilde?
Well, C of R is this whole function that is this function here, and C tilde of R is this function where it's subtracted off, so that it goes to, it's like this function down here, C tilde. Actually, by the way, does anyone know Curie's law? Curie law for the susceptibility, the high temperature susceptibility? I'm sorry. So, do you know what that says?
Question of 1/T.
1/T. Yeah. Okay. And you can see it right there. Okay. See theta. Okay. Because if you're at high temperatures, this correlation function dies off very quickly. So that's just a number. Okay. And then there's an overall 1/T. Out in front. When you're at very high temperatures, it's only the, if you like, the nearest neighbor correlations, which are one, right? Okay. Okay. So let's calculate this. So we still haven't shown this, but if C tilde of R is some function like A e to the minus R over C divided by R to the d minus 2 plus eta. So this is then an interpretation of that, then chi, and assume that the correlation length is long, so that this sum has many terms in it, and it can be replaced by an integral, then chi is beta times the unit of solid angle times A times integral from 0 to infinity e to the minus r over c r to the d minus 1 dr over r to the d minus 2 plus eta. So this is what would be 4 pi in 3 dimensions, 2 pi in 2 dimensions. That's what that intended to mean. And so that if you, sorry, this should be big R. So if you make this your dimensionless variable, call this x, then you have to put in powers of the correlation length to make everything in the integral in terms of x. And so what have you got here? This whole thing in the numerator has dimensions r to the d, and there's an r to the d. So those things will balance out, and you basically need to put in a correlation length to the 2 minus eta out in front to make this dimensionless. So chi goes like c to the 2 minus eta. And that just illustrates the point that I was trying to make, that the susceptibility diverges because the correlation length diverges. In fact, so for h equals 0, so this is then this 0 field susceptibility that we talked about. The correlation length goes like, and this is the definition of the correlation length exponent. And that implies that chi goes like 1 over t minus tc to the nu times 2 minus eta. Just because of this, because chi is this sum. Now, so there are all these exponents that show up in the theory of critical phenomena, one for each physical quantity, and the one for the susceptibility chi of t and h equals 0 goes like 1 over t minus tc to the gamma. So gamma is the susceptibility exponent or in zero field. And the point here is to display the relation between exponents, okay? And the relation is that gamma is equal to nu times 2 minus eta. Yeah. Okay, so just to remind you, eta is the thing which tells you what the power law behavior is. Where did we write this? Yeah. When Xi is infinite. So I have a note to myself here saying that you should look at Carty's book, pages 4 to 5, for more discussion of Ada. And the susceptibility itself, so what does it look like? I mean, it looks like this. Out here it goes like 1 over t. So you can see that this this result is only really correct in the critical region. In other words, so this thing only applies near TC, where the dominant temperature dependence arises from this diverging correlation length. Okay, if you get far away from TC, well, you know the answer up here. It's just 1 over T. Or actually, there's a correction to this 1 over T. So it's 1 over T if you go to really high temperatures, so the T is really high compared to TC. Just like, you can also write this as 1 over T minus TC. This is Curie-Weiss. And this sort of goes over to this as T goes to infinity. You can see that when you're high enough in temperature, you don't care whether TC is some small number or zero. Okay, if you are high enough in temperature. Okay, so these are sort of, this is the very high temperature limit. This is the first correction to the high temperature limit. This is quite rigorous, actually, when you're at high temperatures. If you can tell the difference, actually, so that's, if you can tell the difference between 1 over T minus TC and 1 over T, then you can determine what's called I guess it's the mean field TC, you can essentially determine the coupling constant from that. Okay, we have some questions. Actually, Nicole, did you still have a question?
So you said just a short while ago that this result applies near the critical point. But yeah. I'm wondering where that qualification comes from. How come we did we say it a long time ago when we were starting our math as an assumption?
Yeah, it's because there are corrections to this if you get far enough away from the critical point.
So was it our assumption C
yeah.
tilde goes like A?
Yeah.
Okay.
This, and that A was independent of temperature, if you like, or something like that. Okay, so we had some other questions. Yep.
Does kind goes to infinity at TC?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Assuming you've got no magnetic field, which sometimes can be a challenge. Yes.
So if that means under the integration, there is some factor of T that comes out. Of kind that
there's a beta here.
Yeah, so beta is inversely proportional to t, right? So that means there should be some factor of t that comes out of the integration so that it goes to zero at t equals zero, because otherwise it will blow up.
Oh.
I'm just saying that.
Yeah, but Yeah, I think it's the same kind of story. Yeah, there are some factors that when you get down in here, you're saying.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's right. There's other things that happen before you get to table zero. I mean, you can calculate the low temperature susceptibility rather easily. It's a sort of independent calculation, but when you do that calculation, the correlation length is not large. Yes?
So you say when that the susceptibility diverges when Xi diverges.
Yeah.
But that seems to imply that we know that eta is less than 2. Because if it's
eta, yes.
Remind me.
And I think there's probably some thermodynamic, you can prove some. I mean, typically, like in mean field theory, eta is 0. In the epsilon expansion, eta is of order epsilon squared, where epsilon is thought, you know, is treated as if it were small.
Okay.
So yeah, I mean, that's right. I mean, if you like, if you had a system where, I don't know what it would mean if eta was very large, but it would just mean that the susceptibility didn't diverge, some susceptibility didn't diverge.
Yeah. I'm still not quite sure about the d goes to 0 thing.
D.
Because we haven't actually made an assumption anywhere that T isn't very small.
Oh,
so,
T. I think we did, like I say.
What?
It's all in
oh,
here.
So in that
yeah, in this form of the correlation function.
Okay.
But, yeah, I mean, and of course, yeah, I mean, we haven't said what the scale is.
The correlation function depends on temperature. All right.
Yeah, anyway. Yeah, I think you have to do a different calculation if you want to study the low temperature limit. But you can be sure that the susceptibility is going to go to 0 as T goes to 0, because if all the spins are aligned.
Well, sure.
So it'll come out. It comes out. It's just you have to do it separately. And you don't just put this in
okay.
And say, okay, yep, I'm going to take the correlation length to its low temperature limit. Okay, so let's move on here.
Just to clarify, that formula for calculating chi,
yep.
Is that valid at all temperatures? Or it's
which formula? That one up there?
Chi, TH.
This thing here, yeah, that's valid for all temperatures and fields.
For beta.
The one that has the microscopic, yeah. Yeah, and in fact, that should be 2. Yeah. Yeah, I'm sure it does. I think you should maybe try looking at that when T is 0. And seeing, because at T equals 0, any susceptibility that you get is because of the fact that the spins are not fully polarized. In other words, that the ferromagnetic state has some thermal fluctuations. And those should be exponentially small. Because in the icy model, the only thermal excitation you can get is to actually flip a spin. And that costs you 2H or something like that. So you could actually, in principle, do that calculation easily, actually. Okay. Anything else? Yeah, if everyone's so worried about T equals 0, maybe we should do an exercise about T equals 0. So, yeah. Okay, so now we're on to the second lecture. Now I'd like to talk about more generally about critical exponents. And just remind you of this little picture. And So the point is, as we've said in numerous ways, the thermodynamic functions are non-analytic at TC, and actually, they're non-analytic at TC, and the is characterized by the specific heat. To the minus alpha. This is N2. The order parameter which is the magnetization. N equals zero. For T less than TC. And this is both for H equals zero. So this looks like, well, can look different ways. I guess the comment I would make is that this relation applies on both sides of TC. The exponent is usually identical on both sides of TC. And for many physical systems, it's small. So unlike the susceptibility, which diverges strongly, the specific heat can actually have a log divergence. It can have an exponent which is so small that you might not distinguish it from a log. It can be a cusp, so that it doesn't diverge at all. Those are all possible with the specific heat. Whereas the magnetization develops, actually, let me draw this a little differently. Develops at TC and below, and it's zero up here, and it can this beta, if beta is a small number, as it is in the 2D icing model where it's an eighth, then this thing goes up very steeply. Okay, so in mean field theory, it tends to be a half. And it's not nearly as steep. I forget. In the 3D icing model and liquid gas, it's a third, roughly a third. So in any case, it's a... And I'd just like to make one other comment about nomenclature. When I talk about order parameter, it's more general than just the icing model. There are different kinds of order that can arise. And when I talk about susceptibility, there are different kinds of susceptibilities because there are different kinds of fields that you can apply. Now, that might seem strange, but on the other, you can imagine there are magnetic fields, there's electric fields that you could apply in a dielectric medium. But actually, there's a lot more than that. You can imagine applying a staggered field. Well, maybe you can, maybe you can't. Say that's up on one side and down on its neighbor and so forth, or which oscillates on a microscopic basis. I think I mentioned in the last lecture, you can actually do that with neutrons, which couple to the can couple to the electric moment, the magnetic moments, and have this sort of spatial variation. So in fact, you can measure susceptibilities that correspond to short wavelength fields applied to the sample. Okay. But the point that I wanted to make is that this susceptibility here that we're calculating is the uniform susceptibility, and it's the derivative with respect to a uniform magnetic field of the uniform magnetic moment. And I think all of those things were clear in the way that we developed it. So we look at the uniform magnetization, we apply a uniform magnetic field, and induces a magnetic moment, and the ratio of those is the is this chi, if you like, you could call it chi zero, the susceptibility. So just a comment that when you have a phase transition below which some order parameter grows up from zero, becomes non-zero, at that transition, you expect the susceptibility that you associate with that order parameter to diverge. And this all seems trivial for the icing model, the ferromagnetic icing model, because it seems like there's only one thing that can happen. But imagine, I mean, I don't know, are we doing anything on the icing antiferromagnet on a square lattice?
Not so far.
Okay, yeah. So, but imagine that J were negative. Okay, so that instead of every neighboring spin wanting to be parallel, they want it to be anti-parallel. And if you're on a square lattice, you can do that, right? You know, every other spin is up and every other one is down. So imagine then calculating the magnetic susceptibility for that system to applying a uniform magnetic field. The uniform magnetic field wants to make all the spins parallel, but the nearest neighbor interaction between them wants to make them anti-parallel. So the uniform magnetic field isn't the field that's going to induce that antiferromagnetic order. Okay? So that susceptibility isn't. So if you have an antiferromagnet, just in the case of 1D chain, which of course doesn't order spontaneously, but if you have that wanted to do something like that and you calculated its uniform susceptibility, it wouldn't diverge. As you approach the ordering temperature where they wanted to do that, because you'd be fighting against it. So there are susceptibilities that are associated with order parameters. If you have an order parameter which wants to develop spontaneously at some temperature TC, its susceptibility will diverge at that temperature because it takes nothing to cause that order to happen. There's the magnetization at TC. Yep.
What you just said about, so if you have an order parameter, then its susceptibility will diverge?
If you have an order parameter that wants to spontaneously
right.
grow up at some temperature or some place,
so what I'm wondering is
then the susceptibility to the field that encourages or induces that order is divergent because of the fact that it takes practically none of that to cause it to happen close to TC, which is what you mean by divergent susceptibility.
Right. Yeah, what I'm wondering is that a rule of thumb or is it a proven statement? Is it like a theorem or is it just something that typically is done?
I don't know. I mean, in a sense, the way I've said it, it's almost a tautology. I mean, it's like, set it in a way that it has to be true. So I don't know if that means proof. But you get the idea, right? Okay, magnetization at TC. So say you're doing something. Oh, so magnetization at TC is zero at H equals zero. But say you're looking along this line here and varying the field at T equals TC. So this goes like The plus or minus, this shouldn't really, I shouldn't really call this plus or minus, I should call it the sign, S-I-G-N of H. Okay, actually, why don't we just say that? That's what that is. Gunjan, did you have a question? Or, yeah.
So I have two questions.
Okay.
So let's say, how do we usually, how do we guess these power laws? That's my first question. And how do we guess the value of the critical exponents? Is there a way to do it?
Okay.
Not for all models in general.
No, so how do we know how to write? I mean, originally, of course, this was all empirical.
So it's just,
right? People observed these power laws. Mm-hmm. And they weren't actually that totally clean. In other words, you see some sort of smooth temperature dependence of a specific heat, but then as you got close to this critical temperature, all of a sudden it would have this funny behavior, and similarly, and the susceptibility actually over a much broader range of temperature and as the thing developed. So originally, empirically. So for instance, because of the fact that it was originally experimental or empirical, people didn't know whether alpha was the same for T greater than TC as it was for T less than TC. They couldn't tell, because you can't really measure. I mean, it's similar, but they couldn't tell for sure. So there was like an alpha and an alpha prime. It's only in the context of the theory, regeneralization group theory, that one expects that to be the same, a single electron.
So for some deeper reason, this is true.
Yeah. Oh, then the answer to your second question, which is how do you calculate it?
Yes.
That's the whole point of this course. But you're going to calculate them, Thursday? Yeah, you'll calculate all these exponents Thursday in mean field approximation.
I mean, for statistical, it's like 1D Ising model give you the, I mean, same value of critical exponents as right. Experimentally.
Well, the 1D models, so it doesn't order. So if you like, nothing happens. I mean, a lot of things happen as T goes to zero.
Mm-hmm.
But there's no finite temperature or phase transition in the in any 1D system. Okay, so let's keep going. This other one you already saw, susceptibility. Chi equals D times T minus TC minus gamma, also both both sides of TC. And I should have said this delta here, which you can calculate in mean field theory, tends to be a number larger than 1, like 3 or something like that. You know? And this gamma is 2 nu, basically. So whatever nu is. This tends to be larger than 1. Okay, so what are the questions? There's two simple questions. Actually, why all these power laws? What do they mean? And two, how do you calculate them? Okay, so those are the key questions. Okay, so we want to sort of approach this in the simplest approximation, which is mean field theory. And I hope everyone reviewed lecture zero. But you may recall some, it corresponds to writing down some effective Hamiltonian, which is minus and then going through the steps. And I think we did that back on September 4th. Okay. So I'd like to approach this in a slightly different way, which I don't think I actually got to in that lecture, but it was in the notes. So equivalently, we can write a variational probability distribution in the following way. I'll just call the density matrix. Which is a little bit different from the quantum mechanical, well, it's the thermodynamic density matrix. So let's say, call it rho sub n, which is a function of all the spins. Okay? So.
What distinguishes the thermodynamic one from the quantum mechanical one?
Well, if you're in a, behavior is defined by a wave function, then you know you write the density matrix as it's like an operator, the thing with itself. This is the one that will give you the thermal behavior. It's diagonal in the energy representation, and it's basically e to the minus beta t. That's what it is. Okay. And unfortunately, e to the minus beta time or e to the minus beta h is not the easiest thing to calculate, and so we have to make approximations. So, what does this mean? In the notes for the lecture, and in for lecture zero, and in my book, and in countless other places, you can prove what's essentially a theorem, which says that the if you imagine all possible, so this is. What I've written here on the left is a distribution function which depends on the value of every spin. And basically what it tells you is the probability that that particular spin configuration occurs in a thermal distribution. That's what this is on the left here. And there is this variational theorem that says that you could, well, so, and you could use this to calculate the free energy. If you know this distribution function, you can use it to calculate the free energy of the system. Okay, it's the expectation value of H, the Hamiltonian, is the internal energy with respect to this, minus T times the entropy, which is the expectation value of log of this distribution function. Okay, and the variational theorem says that the distribution function that minimizes that free energy for your Hamiltonian is the exact distribution function, which is, as it turns out, e to the minus beta h over z. And then the exact free energy is minus t log z. Okay? But if you put in some other distribution function that isn't e to the minus beta h over z, you can still calculate a free energy that just associated, gives you the average energy, and you can calculate the entropy associated with that distribution function, and you can get a free energy type thing, but that free energy will always be higher than the exact free energy. And it's easy to prove that, but I'm not going to do it because it's easier. You'll believe it if you do it yourself, and it's only about two or three steps. Okay. So one trick, so the whole thing about these variational principles, at least I like, people who, well, a lot of people like, actually, I guess, is that you can write down some approximation to the, some approximate probability distribution that is actually something that you could use in a calculation. And if that approximation has some parameters in it, which are initially undetermined, at the end, when you do the calculation, you can minimize your result with respect to those parameters and then believe that you're getting closer to the truth. Okay? Now, mean field theory, one way of defining, a very useful way of defining mean field theory is to say that we're going to approximate the distribution function of the n spin system, or the n body system, by a product of distribution functions for a single degree of freedom. Okay, you take that product. That's a really good way of defining what mean field theory means. Okay? And this icing problem is just a great illustration of how that works. Okay? So basically, this is not true. This is a cheapo approximation, which just happens to usually give you a lot of qualitatively useful results. Okay? And for critical behavior, it's always very wrong. But well, no, I shouldn't say that. There are some cases. Like in BCS theory of superconductivity, it's pretty well exact. It gives you the right answer. Okay, and you can, and as you study this theory, you can figure out why, you know, when it's going to be good and when it's going to be bad. Okay, and but we won't go too deeply into that. But let's see. Okay, so here, this is it. So the question is, what is rho s? First question you might ask. Okay. Well, there's not a lot of choice, okay? Because you know that the sum over s equals plus or minus 1 of rho s is 1, because that's the only, that exhausts the possibilities. And you can also define this is just the average value of the spin s. And so you call that m. And, well, you know, rho is a function which only has two argument values, possible values. So you've done it. That's it. The end of the story. This determines. So rho of 1 is equal to 1 plus m over 2. And rho of minus 1 equals 1 minus m over 2. Why doesn't it give me another board? Okay, try it this way. Oh. learn how to use these things one of these days. Okay, so now we're going to use that to calculate some averages. Calculate the average value of H. And that's just equal to that's the field, sum over spins of the field, minus J and Z over 2 M squared. So this is the number of nearest neighbor pairs. Z is just the number of nearest neighbors of any spin. So it's like 4 for the square lattice. That's the expectation value of the Hamiltonian. And then the entropy is that. And that's going to be equal to minus sum, I'm going to have to sum over all the spins, equal plus or minus 1, product over R, rho of SR, sum over R prime log rho of SR prime. Okay. So the log turns this product into a sum of logs, this thing here. That's how I get that. And then this itself is the probability function. This is rho n here. And so this gives me the average of the log of rho n. And what you can see right away is that if you look inside the sum, everything here is a one spin term. So when you have this huge product, practically the trace over practically everything except one spin gives you one. And the other one gives you some sum involving the sum over a particular S. So that's equal to, and there's n such terms. Well, now this is the one, this is what we defined over there. Okay, everything else cancels out. And this is equal to minus n. Basically, what is it? It's 1 plus m over 2 log of 1 plus m over 2 plus 1 minus m over 2 log 1 minus m over 2. And so then I can put together the free energy per site. I'll just divide through by n. This is 1 over n. So we have minus HM minus JZ over 2 M squared plus T So that's the free energy in the mean field approximation. And And actually, that's what's new about this calculation, because remember before, we did the mean field approximation. We said, okay, there's some effective Hamiltonian. And then we determined this effective Hamiltonian by saying that the average field that a spin sees from the external field plus the interaction with its neighbors is H effective. So we got some stuff. So we never actually had a form for the free energy. So now that's the free energy in mean field theory for the Ising model. And it better give you the same answer. So remember I said the strategy is you write down some one particle density matrix that contains a parameter. We found that for the Ising model, there's only one parameter that you can have, which is the magnetization per site. So now the last step is following the logic is to minimize the free energy with respect to M to see which M you get. Okay? So, and you better get the same answer. So that's minus H minus ZJM plus, and then you have to differentiate this thing here, T over 2. And you can see that it's log of 1 plus M over 1 minus M. Okay, and then basically you go through the algebra and you find that M is equal to tanh theta.
The first one, so you assume that for each row S, you have only diagonal elements.
Yeah.
And for the non-diagonal, they're all zero.
Right.
So why?
Because it's a thermal distribution, so you don't have any. The off-diagonal ones all average to zero, basically, when you take the thermodynamic average. That's sort of like back in the basic principles of statistical mechanics, which leads to the distribution function being e to the minus beta h, which also has no, which is diagonal. I mean, it's in the energy representation. So the statement is that the thermal probability distribution is diagonal in the energy representation. Okay, and so if you imagine what the off-diagonal ones might be doing, they're oscillating at some very high frequency in time, and thermodynamics is the long time average limit. It doesn't take into account the fact that those atoms are moving around, because you don't see that.
Okay?
So, yeah. So the off-diagonal elements tend to have time dependences, which are differences between the energies of, or frequencies, which are differences between the energies of many body states. And the assumption is that if you're doing a thermodynamic measurement, which by definition means long time average, then those average to zero. You have another question?
Yeah. Another question is, why you minimize the free energy rather than the, just the H or?
Oh, it's because that's all tied back to the variational principle. The variational principle basically says that the probability distribution that minimizes the free energy defined in this way, in whichever way we did, is e to the minus beta h, is the exact one, okay? So the assumption is that if you write down an approximate probability distribution function with parameters, then calculate the free energy, minimize it with respect to those parameters, you're getting closer to the right answer. Okay. And this approximation, well, so in this particular case, we're making a particular ansatz, a conjecture about what the form is, which is a form that would probably apply if correlations were not important. In other words, if each spin could be thought of as acting somewhat independently, except for maybe some average effect of its neighbors. Okay. And we know, I mean, this whole discussion leading up to this has told us that that's not a very good assumption for a critical point. On the other hand, if you're far away from a critical point, it isn't a bad assumption. And you can actually calculate thermal properties well away from a critical point in mean field theory and expect to get reasonably accurate answers. For instance, the Curie law and the Curie-Weiss law, where TC is JZ, are fine for high temperatures. So this is an approximation that, for sure, it's a crude, gross approximation. But it's also a calculation that you can do, and it's also one of the first calculations that you should do when you're faced with a new problem. Because even though it doesn't give you the right answer, it requires or contains important information about the problem. For instance, like the nature of the order parameter. As I said, the behavior well away from critical points. It allows you to analyze the problem and understand what's at stake. It just doesn't give you accurate results. So, but because it's doable, it's useful. Okay, so you get that. You can analyze this free energy in a particular region of the phase diagram where the magnetization is small compared to 1. And you would do that then. This is nice. You've got linear terms, you've got a quadratic term, and then you've got these highly nonlinear terms. Okay, but you can immediately see that if the magnetization is small, then you could expand these out. And it's useful to do that, to analyze the behavior around, like at high temperatures or around the mean field critical point where M is small. Okay, and so first of all, I want to define mean field TC as JZ, and then expand F for small m. And basically what you get is that F is minus HM minus TC M squared over 2. From here, if M is 0, you get a T log 2. Why do I have minus? Yeah, it is minus T log 2, which is unimportant. And then when you expand this to first order, you get a T over 2 M squared. And then if you keep going, you get, that's 4 factorial. And then you could keep going. Yep.
4 factorial is 24.
Well, maybe it's 3 factorial. Oh, it's 4 factorial. Yeah, you're right. It's 3 factorial. 3 times 2. Anyway, it's 12. Sorry. Anyway, you cut it. It's 12. So what? Oh, and then we can rearrange this as... Okay. So, and then you could use this to calculate what? The first 4 critical exponents that I defined, the specific heat, the magnetization, the order parameter exponent, alpha, beta, gamma, delta. Okay, and that's Thursday? Yeah. Okay. So I won't do that. But I will draw a couple of pictures. Let's see. What's this thing do? You're going to have to give me lessons on this. Oh, wow.
Some of them are broken.
Some of them are broken. Okay, well, it's not just me then. Yeah, okay. So, just get me one. Yeah, that's the one I want. Yeah, I think you're right. Yeah, okay. So I just want to draw you some pictures of this. So this is Landau theory. Okay, so this, did I say this was called the Landau expansion? This is the Landau expansion. Yeah.
The critical exponent give us an intuition about the behavior of the system near the critical point.
Right.
So why we are spanning around m equal to 0? I mean, we're going to compute the critical exponent from this expression?
Yeah, because so at the critical point, like say in zero field, for instance, or doesn't matter, but say in zero field, if you're above TC, then m is 0. If you're below TC, it grows up from 0.
Yeah.
So there's a region around TC where m is always small.
Okay.
And so you can analyze that region. And that's where the critical exponents apply.
Okay. So this Landau expansion is just for this particular system. This Landau expansion is just for this particular system.
Yes and no. I mean, you know, like, it comes up. It's a generic, it's actually a sort of a generic model of a critical point. So it comes up everywhere. It's not just, but I've just derived it for this system. But this thing that you've got, you know, you can couple with a field that gives you a linear coupling, that you've got a quadratic term that can change sign at TC. And then if you imagine that this thing is negative, then this is an inverted parabola, so, you know, the energy is unbounded from below. However, you've also got this term that pulls it back up. Okay, so this has stable solutions, just keeping those terms. That's a description, if you like. It's a way of describing many theoretical systems.
John, yeah. So we see that in mean field theory, it's JZ that we have to identify with the critical temperature,
right,
because we get T minus TC.
Right.
As the coefficient of our quadratic term. Right,
right. Yeah, actually, so let me just draw this picture then of what it looks like. So if you plot the free energy as a function of m, then you can see that at high temperatures, it looks like that. Okay. On the other hand, if T equals TC, then you have no quadratic term, and you have a pure quartic, so it looks like this. It's very flat in here. But if this term is negative, so if T is less than TC, then it looks like this. Not a very good picture, but you get the idea. Okay. So, and it's symmetric, m goes to minus m. So the point is that for t less than tc, there's two minima here, which are at a point which you would call m of t. So it says that the system either wants to be in a state with this value of m, or this value of m. So conceptually, if you want to think about how a phase transition occurs, as you cool down the temperature, at high temperatures, the free energy wants the order parameter to be zero. At this TC, where the quadratic term vanishes, you can imagine that the system has a lot of fluctuations in it, because this potential function, if you like, is very flat. Okay, so you can imagine even in mean field theory that the fluctuations build up around TC. But then all of a sudden, when T is less than TC, the quadratic term is negative, so it curves down. And there's a new minima. There's two of them, of course, because there's a symmetry. And actually, as you continue to lower TC, the position of this minimum moves out to some low temperature value. So this is Landau's picture of a second order phase transition. Now, and this picture applies in zero magnetic field. So I've taken H equals zero. Now you might also wonder what happens when H is not equal to zero. And so that picture is a little bit trickier to draw freehand on the board. Yeah.
You said second order phase transition. Why is it a second order phase transition?
Oh, it's continuous because you can see that. Is your question what is the definition of a second order phase transition, or is your question why this is a continuous transition? Okay, well, a second order phase transition is some historical term that says that it's the second derivative of the free energy that changes discontinuously. Okay, so it's like when people thought that this was somehow an important physical way to characterize phase transition, they call them first order or second order, where the first derivative changes discontinuously to the second and so forth. Okay, having said that, when I say a second order phase transition, I mean a continuous phase transition where some order parameter is zero above it and then grows up continuously below it. So that's what I mean. And you can see how that happens here because, you know, if you just imagine T equals TC, you've got this quartic, flat quartic, and then you bring T infinitesimally below TC, then you know that the curvature is downward. So the single minimum splits continuously into two minima. So that's, I would say, why it's a model of a continuous transition. Any other questions? Just try to draw the picture. So this is T greater than TC. And this would be So in both cases, if you look at n equals 0, I guess there's it's linear because of the linear term in the energy. If you're above Tc, the application of a magnetic field moves the minimum of the free energy out to some positive value of m, which is just the simple statement that the field induces a magnetization. If you're below Tc, well, it tips, it favors one well over the other, and also rearranges them slightly, but it favors one well over the other. Okay? I think it's getting late. We can have questions, but I think we should probably stop.